All right, so today I'm joined by Matthew O'Connor and Barnaby O'Connor of Ivy Films. Guys, welcome. How are you doing?
Hello, we're good. Thank you. Thank you for having us on.
Absolute pleasure. Yeah, you guys have been busy, busy, busy people for the last, well, decade, making all kinds of films and documentaries. And we'll talk about your latest project, The Pickup Game, obviously. But I guess before we do, it'd be good to get a bit of your origin story, sort of a little bit about, you know, who you guys are and what's got you to where you are today. I don't know who wants to start first.
Okay. I don't mind. Should I go first?
Go on.
Okay. So we have been making films for quite a long time now. We originally started off making short films, short narrative films, and music videos. And I think the idea, the aim was always to kind of get into feature film, fictional feature film projects. But then, and we did have, we did try and make a couple of features, very low budget, very guerrilla style, very indie style, which we put a lot of heart and soul into, but they didn't necessarily, they weren't necessarily like the breakout Sundance hits we were hoping for, you know. And then sort of as one of the films, one of the features that we made is called A Horse With No Name. And it had, the idea was we were going to try and make a film up as we went along, but we weren't going to tell the actors that that's what we were doing. And we made a documentary about that process of making this film up on the fly.
Okay.
So every day, literally every morning, we'd get up and we'd try and write some pages and write some scripts, write some scenes. And then we'd go out and try and film that. And it was this sort of road. We had a very, very loose structure, which is a road trip film. This guy meets a girl in New York. They have this wonderful day together. She leaves to go to California, and then he drives across America to be with her again, basically. And that was the structure. But there was no script. There was no beyond that.
Wait,
that was
a, did they know there was no script, or were they?
No,
like,
they didn't.
No, they didn't. I mean,
as an actor, I'm like, I want to see the script first. Like that's
we were. You know, Before Sunrise and Before Sunset, I think Ethan Hawke kind of movies that are very, you know, off the cuff. And we kind of had this idea of like, okay, we'll make this romantic movie in a similar vein. And we'll plot out four or five little story points, and then we'll just make up the script the day before. And so this crazy idea of let's go and make a film and a behind the scenes documentary, it's okay in your own backyard, but we went all the way to New York, which is very expensive and very difficult to kind of navigate around. And then on top of that, we put a road trip in, taking us from New York to California. So, yeah.
Why not? In for a penny, in for a pound, or many a pounds or dollars. Yeah. So was that all self-funded? I mean, I'm getting the vibe. You've done a lot of self-funded sort of guerrilla stuff. And at a point, I guess you get to a point where you're like, that's fine for the first few, but you can't do that unless you're the Duplass brothers. Like that doesn't run forever. So what was that period for you? When did that sort of happen? And was it a conscious decision pretty quickly, or did it build up organically where you were like, we got to get funding now for something?
So that film that we've just been talking about was 2008. Yeah. So that was a little over 12 years ago. We self-funded that. We had $10,000 that we'd saved up, which obviously is nothing in the grand scheme of things for making a film. But I think one of the things that came out of that, and one of the things that came out of making the documentary about that process was, okay, it is actually possible to make a documentary with a lot less money that is kind of higher production value than a feature film at that level, you know. Mm-hmm. So then what happened after that was we started a project called California High, and we had a little bit of money for that, but we didn't have very much. It was basically we had part funded it ourselves. We found a guy in the US that was also interested in funding that, and we made it for a very small amount of money, relatively speaking. I think it cost about $30,000. Which is a lot, but it's not. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, it's very small. And that ended up getting selected at a few festivals. mainly sort of not none of the household names won, but kind of second tier festivals, and it got some reasonably good reviews. And then it got picked up by a US distributor, and it was on iTunes, and it was on Amazon, and it did quite well on iTunes. It got made into like the top 10 for a period of a month or so. And I think it that kind of proved to people that we could at least do something. I think that was enough of like a calling card, even though it wasn't like incredibly successful financially, and it was sort of moderately successful from a festivals and a reviews point of view. It kind of showed people, okay, these two, they can do something. They have some competence or whatever you want to call it.
And you found an audience, I guess, even if it's a small one. I think that's always quite a big thing, right? Go to a distributor and say, we've got some people that actually watch our stuff, and this is only like movie number two.
Yeah. It was quite nice to screen the documentary in a couple of sort of small cinemas, get the kind of feedback from the audience. The movie did relatively well within the educational kind of sector of distribution, educational wise, libraries and universities and schools, purely because the content matter was whether or not California will legalize marijuana and the implications of that. And I think from a creative standpoint, that was like the first non sort of fictional or entertainment style film that we made, which was looking at a very, very difficult subject from both sides of the coin and saying, okay, this, along with lots of other topics, abortion and so on and so forth, they're very, very, very complicated. But generally speaking, you get the black and white option. It's yes or it's no, and there's no real in between. So what happens when it comes to voting, you have to really understand both sides of the argument to feel that you're educated enough to check that box. And I think when sort of starting the latest film, it's very similar. We're taking a very, very difficult subject matter that polarizes everybody, and we're trying to present it in a way that says, look, okay, these are the facts. It's time to start a discussion. We're not pushing an opinion. We're trying to initiate a discussion. And that, from a documentary perspective, has kind of been the style that we've gone for as of recent years.
It's the power of filmmaking, right? To be able to actually, you said polarizing, and I mean, the world clearly is getting more and more polarized, not less and less. And so we need more stuff, more conversations, and just more mature conversations around all kinds of topics where you can see different vantage points, whether or not you agree with them is a different matter. But to not be so black and white and just pitch our flag in one corner and say that's it, and that is the only ever can be kind of solution. So that sounds to me, and if I'm wrong, stop me at any point, but that comes intrinsically from who you are as human beings. That sort of ethos, was that just part of who you are and how you've grown up, as sort of your own core values and how you see things in the world? Or was that a conscious sort of decision as a film company to go down that road?
I think that's quite a difficult question to answer, but I think it comes from, when you make a documentary on anybody, you spend a lot of time with them. Mm-hmm. And even people that are, that do things that can be very unpleasant and very unkind, I don't want to excuse the behavior. And this is really important, but you can't help but think like, okay, where does that come from in that person? And that's
mentality of a lot of it.
Mm. Yeah, that's quite different. Like I said, I don't want to excuse the behavior, but there's definitely been a few cases where, and sometimes it's difficult if you feel that someone is just misguided or they're immature. I think there are some people that are bad, to really simplify it. There are some sort of bad people out there that I think you have to be very or very very sort of damaged and manipulative and dangerous people that you have to be very careful about. But I think there's also people that are just confused, or they're lost, or they're misguided, and all those, and some, and but sometimes those actions have very real and damaging consequences to other people. Mm-hmm. And that is quite difficult sometimes to reconcile in your head. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, we're kind of touching a little bit without implicitly talking about the pickup game, and obviously the film, we are kind of touching on that implicitly, sort of with what came to my mind watching it. And a lot of what came to my mind was that there's a lot of insecurities that exist mm-hmm. within that sphere from every side of the equation. The people that are doing it and running these boot camps, the people that are attending them, the women that are on the other side of it as well, that, it, you know, they use the word, it works on them. And, but one, I can't remember the lady who's a coach.
Minnie Lane.
Who was great, because Minnie is talking, I think she spoke about how, but it works only on a certain maybe type of person. Mm. And so it's just really this festering cycle of insecurities, which then is a bigger conversation about just, you know, who we are as human beings. And that's just a very microcosm of it. I'm getting ahead of the curve here, though. Let's go back.
Can I just add something quickly? I did want to. So just to give like a really short, brief history. So basically, we made California High, and we had some limited success with California High, and then we started working on the Pickup Game, which was one of our most recent projects. And what happened was that was the first project that we got real funding for, and that was financed by a guy based out of New Zealand. But I just wanted to add that we had already started filming stuff for the Pickup Game. So we'd kind of found this niche, we found this industry, we had this idea, and we thought, okay, let's start putting some things together. And we'd interviewed some people, and we'd made some reels, we'd made like some teasers and some trailers. And I think having that to show people, that makes it so much more palatable, because you can say, look, you know, what's your idea? Well, you can sit there and talk about it for a couple of hours. Well, you can say, okay, look, here's 2.5-3 minutes, just watch this, and this will give you a good sense of it. And I think that being able to do that came out of California High. You know, you make a documentary, you learn your lessons, you learn about production values, you learn about getting better sound, you learn about kind of flow and editing, and so it was all sort of cumulative. And even some of those early projects that we did that didn't go anywhere, it was a huge learning experience.
I think this is kind of one of the things, is that if you look at what is the standard process of pitching an idea to a network to get your film commissioned, is synopsis, a little bit of footage with the talent, and kind of a brief story of where you wish to take it. And I think it's much easier to physically show somebody something rather than just talk about it.
They get a sense of your style and your tone and all that stuff, right? So for people listening, that, you know, just like younger filmmakers that are going to have, you know, maybe an interest in then building their careers, and they've just come out of maybe, you know, doing their film course, and they don't know what the world even looks like as a filmmaker, what would be some of the bits of advice you would give them? Because a lot would go immediately to the, I want to be pitching my stuff to get, you know, funded by a Netflix and Amazon or whatever big distributor it is. But to your point, that experience of cutting your teeth on something that's a little bit more low key, for lack of a term, has its benefits. Like, what advice would you give to them? Or what would you say to your younger selves if you were starting out again, if you were approaching the film world?
See, we probably have two very different opinions.
That's even better, but that's awesome. No, but that's awesome, because it shows just, you know, how this thing is. It's just a game of opinions anyway. So, but what would you say, Barnaby, then, if it was from your vantage
point? Okay, so for a number of years, I've complained at the mammoth tasks that we've set ourselves. When you make a documentary, when you make a feature film, even when you make a sort of a middle-length short film, you're talking years. It's not months, days, weeks. It's years. And the more that you do, the more you learn. So, you know, from your pre-production, your post-production, then your sales after. It's like with our final movie, it's the film is finished. It took 4 years to make, but it's nowhere near finished in terms of that journey of the film. So my recommendation is start small and build on that. So start on a 3-minute video of a story and try and capture, you know, the arc of then do a 10-minute, then do a half an hour, because the more you get to learn about filming, about dealing with actors, about, you know, your preparation, your storyboards, about organization and locations and sound and the airplanes flying over, all of these things. If you did that and you spent a lot of money, you know, you can't go back and reshoot it. Whereas if you start small, you can learn to turn the refrigerator off or the aircon. And so I would say smaller projects that you can get through quicker and learn from each of those, you know, be it composition, be it blocking, be it narrative. It's much easier to, with the learning curve, I think, the smaller projects. But I think Matt may disagree on that.
Let's find out.
No, I actually agree. I think one of the biggest mistakes that we made is we did everything full scale. So the first film that we made a few short films, which, you know, and then we made a feature film. And the thing is, we hadn't learned enough at that point. But bearing in mind, we didn't go to film schools and we didn't have any training. So a lot of the lessons that we learned were very time consuming and expensive from that point of view. Like, for example, the first film we did, the sound was terrible. The exposure in all of the shots is terrible. I mean, it's very, very amateur. But we went away and we filmed it, and then we came back and we edited it together, and it's like, well, we've committed to doing this now, you know. And that took like a year and a half to put it together, and what we ended up with was you've learned maybe a little bit about editing and story and structure, but the whole thing is poorly framed, poorly exposed, terrible sound quality. And I think
can I just quickly add something to that? It, as a kind of caveat to what I said, I wouldn't have done it any other way, because the experiences that we've had of our first film was shot in Greece on a campsite. And so we lived in Greece on a campsite with five friends for a month and a half. And the film that we produced was on the poor quality side in terms of an emotional experience or something to remember. And keep you driving forward with enthusiasm, because it is a roller coaster of really negative emotions and really high emotions of yes, it's great, no, it's going to be a failure. It's, you know, so
it was your film school, basically. You know, you were learning on the job. But to your point, I think that's a really big one, the life experiences that we have when working with other filmmakers and creatives are the kinds of things you don't necessarily get in the traditional 9-to-5 office job. You're getting to do things that I don't know how many times I end up saying to friends, as filmmakers, we do and see things that you would never get to see. Like, when would you get to smoke out a train from, like, you know, 1885, or go and be on a campsite in Greece for a month with your friends and then make a film? Like,
yeah.
It is actually, for all the ups and downs, something that we're quite lucky to get to do, even though it's our choice to do it, because you're living a life that's got some kind of rich tapestry to it. And I guess that then fuels your next projects too, right? Like, what you've learned from those moves it to the
next.
Well,
I, in terms of film school, I mean, I see it's all film school. Every single project is film. Even the pickup game. I mean, the pickup game was... we can maybe get to that in a second, but the pickup game was, it felt like being forged in a fire of like, are you going to be able to survive this experience? But it was still a huge learning experience from it. I don't think film school, you know, I'm sorry, I'm being a bit abstract here, but like, whether you go to film school or not, every film that you make is a huge learning experience.
True.
And I don't think that ever ends. Yeah, I don't think that.
What was the biggest kind of sort of learning thing on the pickup game then in terms of that? Was it the fact that this was the first funded film with other producers and that was a different sort of thing to navigate? Or were there more sort of big takeaways for you guys as a creative partnership?
Do you want to go first, Hans?
I may need a bit of time to think about it. I mean, one of... This will answer the question in a roundabout kind of way, is that if we go back to advice to people who are starting out who want to make movies, we were very fortunate that we have each other with which to work with and trust and encourage, because sometimes, you know, Matt would have a bad day, but I'm very enthusiastic about this particular scene, so I can see how it's going to work out, how we edit it, and so on and so forth. I think if you're an individual by yourself, the advice would be get out there and try and meet other people with similar interests, be that a cameraman, a lighting guy, you know, audio, producer, and just people that you get along with, because that makes that whole process a lot easier. And because we've made films by ourselves for decades, it was a bit of a strange new kind of experience to have, you know, the executive producer funding money, wanting things by a certain time, reviewing things, working with, you know, a story editor as well, is that all of a sudden your team gets bigger. And if you're not 100% certain how to deal with that, it can be quite a big learning curve. You have to be diplomatic. You have to, you know, encourage other people to input into the story and, you know, for the benefit of the film. So that for me was quite a new experience.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to add to that, so the Pickup Game was the first fully funded film that we did. And I just want to preface everything that I'm about to say with, I completely understand why the things that happened. And had I been in the same position as the exec producer guy that was funding it, I would have reacted in the same way. But basically, and I think this is important in terms of understanding it, it never goes, it's never smooth. You know, big projects are never smooth. It isn't, whether you're building a road or a house or a hospital or whatever. It's always difficult. There's always delays. There's always, it's hard. It's very, very hard to keep things on track and on budget. And basically what happened with the Pickup Game was, we were supposed to deliver in March of 2018. And because it was an incredibly complex story, because we're trying to tell the story of, like a movement or a subculture and an industry. We're not telling the story of one individual person or, and it was very, from an editing point of view, it was very, very challenging. And basically what happened was we overran and we ran out of money. And we ran out of money in March of 2018, and we didn't actually finish the film until October of 2018. So that means we were working for 6 months without for nothing. And in the, I think there's a really, really big thing with films where that last five, I think we talked about this before this podcast, Ash, but that last 5 or 10% can really make or break a movie. It's like those little, you know, the finishing touches, the sound design, the color grading, those tweaks to the edit. And it's very, very difficult to kind of, you know, what was happening is we were sending out cuts and other people were watching them going, well, this is crap. Basically, I mean, not in quite such unkind words, but basically, look, this doesn't work. It's too long. It's da, da, da. We, you know, this is a great subject matter. Why have you made a boring documentary about it? and to try and keep people on side and to try and keep people's faith in you, like that's really, really difficult. And then at the same point in time, editing, especially, you know, a feature doc, it's like a really, really slow process. You know, maybe you get through half a minute or a minute or a couple of minutes a day. If you're a small team, if you got three or four editors on it, okay, maybe, you know, it could be quicker. But it's very, very hard to kind of keep people's faith. And sometimes you just have to be difficult and say, like, no, like, we are okay. Just leave us leave it with us. We could have quite easily in February, March of 2018, we could have quite easily said, okay, do you know what? Somebody else can do this. And there were talks of that. There was a lot of conversation backwards and forwards about, we'll get another editor on and we'll just pay them and they can finish it. And it's like, no, I always felt that we could make a good film. It just took a little bit longer than we had anticipated.
Which happens. What I'm more intrigued about is how you as individuals reconciled that gap. And by gap, I mean the gap between what people were seeing in the physical world at that time with something that wasn't finished and what you envisioned it being able to be, because that's kind of the, for lack of a term, challenge of an artist when it meshes with business, that you can see the vision, even though it's not materialized yet. And yet you're hearing from all these other sources right now, no, this hits back, rejection. How did you as individuals deal with that? Because I'm sure it had its ups and downs, but you managed to get there. I think that's an important conversation around the mindset when you're in those moments.
I mean, if I can just go first on this one quickly. The thing is, okay, so I'm not Spielberg, and I wouldn't liken myself to Spielberg, but I remember Spielberg talking about when he made Jaws. And Jaws for him was a nightmare. There was all kinds of technical problems. It was way over budget, way over time. And I think at many points in time, he thought that was the end of his career. But he just knew that, okay, if I can just finish this. If you listen to him talk about it now, he says it's the hardest film he ever had to make was Jaws. But it also, I think, if you don't have pedigree, if you haven't made films that have been successful, you can't say, well, look, don't worry, I know what I'm doing. If it's your first one, if it's your first big one and someone else is paying, you can't say that. It's just like, well, you clearly don't, because not according to what I'm watching, you don't. But that kind of kept me going. That's how I always felt, was if we can just finish it, it will be okay. And we are committed. We're kind of pot committed, to use a kind of poker term. We're all in. This is years of work. We just have knuckled down and grind it out and finish it. And that requires a certain amount of rectitude, I guess, not to sort of sound, but not, you know, not to try and sound self-flattering, but I think there's a certain, I don't know. There was no option. I could pull the plug. We could pull the plug. We could give it to the other editor, and then someone else essentially finishes your film for you. And I don't know many people that would be willing to do that.
I think the thing is that sometimes, and this happens between Matt and myself all the time. You know, we say this scene or this script or this short film or music video is in a rough draft, and the other person can't see it. So, you know, you haven't got your overlays, you haven't got your cutaways, you haven't got the music, you haven't got your stingers, you haven't got the color correction. And sometimes that makes it quite difficult to sort of get the full feeling of the film across, especially if you're working on individual sections, because you forget the things that come beforehand. So, without kind of plot spoiling the documentary, is you have the pickup game. You have a sort of quite an important scene at the beginning of the film and then the big reveal at the end. But if you look at those as an individual piece, they don't quite match. So in order to review the piece of work, you have to watch an hour and a half, you know, film. And once you've done that 20 times every day, all day, for years, you can literally parrot back what people are going to say. But from an outsider's perspective, maybe they can't quite see your vision. And so it's sort of building that relationship and talking through what that vision is to a point where they feel comfortable in that direction. And, you know, as mentioned before, we did work with other, other people contributed to the success of the film. And, you know, hand on heart, we couldn't have got to that position without a team effort. And this goes back to what I was saying before, is that working with a team, it's different, and it's a really good learning experience. And hopefully, without using like a sales term, you know, the boat has to go in the same direction, because if one person's rowing backwards, there's a problem. So you do have to have lots and lots of meetings and plate smashing.
But yeah, when it does, you can go much further because there's more of you moving with that momentum. And then it's more about just getting people to buy into that vision, but also trust implicitly in the fact that you guys can execute and that you've done it before. So, you know, it was clearly the perfect sort of storm of all of that with experience and team with this project. And so where is the project at now, just for people? I know it had its festival run and has or had been released in the States. Is that correct? Don't know if you want to give a little bit of info into sort of, I guess, what it's done festival wise, and then we can talk a bit more about it.
Okay. So it premiered at Hot Docs in Toronto, which is quite a big documentary festival. That was a very, very cool experience. we can come back to that. And it played at Doc NYC as well, and the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival, all of which are kind of fairly well known on the documentary circuit. We sold it to Stars in the US, and we've sold it to a number of TV channels around the world. And we are launching it in the UK on the 14th of June, 2021 on Amazon and Apple TV pay-per-view, basically.
And I'm assuming a lot of that stuff with the distribution and the deals with the likes of Stars and even the festival discussions was done as part of that team collaborative or because that's something people, I think, always find interesting. It's the question of, how did you get into that festival, or how did you get that agreement with that distributor? And that's always like the golden goose people want to chase, but it's normally a lot more just free flowing than that.
Okay, I just want to give a shout out to a guy called Alex Rogalski, who is one of the programmers at Hot Docs.
Cool.
Who, in addition to being a very nice and amenable guy, he cold picked that documentary for us. And a lot of times what happens with that, this is my theory, this is my hearsay, but anyway, so this is not, you know, just an opinion here, but a lot of times with festivals, you know, a film will be with a sales agent will have connections with a festival, and they will kind of lobby the festival to include it. And there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that goes on. Yeah. But what happened was we submitted to Hot Docs. We didn't know anybody there. We didn't have any connections. We didn't lobby anyone. And one of the programmers at Hot Docs watched it and basically put it forward. And I think there is a lot to be said for someone that will do that, that will actually watch your film in its entirety. Because I think, and it's not really the fault of the, you know, festivals, they have thousands of submissions, tens of thousands of submissions, hundreds of thousands, some of them. It's very, very difficult to sort through all that stuff. But we were incredibly lucky that he kind of found the film in amongst all of the submissions, and he decided to champion it. And off the back of Hot Docs, we met a guy called Stephen Morse, who's an Emmy nominated producer. He's done some very big documentaries for Netflix, and he came to one of the screenings and he said, I like your film, I'd like to help you sell it, basically. And that's how we got the distribution deal. So we had And we had a lot of distribution companies that wanted, like traditional distributors that wanted to come on and represent the film. And we were a little bit wary of distributors. I mean, that's a whole other conversation. But Stephen was much more, look, I'll take a small percentage. I like the film. If I sell it, you pay me. It was a much, much simpler setup. And we thought, okay, fine. And off the back of that, we got the Stars deal. We got several other TV deals around the world. We found a small kind of distribution in the UK to handle like some of the other countries. But for the, yeah, I mean, that's something we can talk about a lot if you like. It really depends on.
I don't think we have to delve into it too much. You've kind of answered it in the fact that it happened quite organically and naturally and predicated by the quality of the work, as opposed to you hustling to try and sort of chase things down. I think that's kind of the nature of how it does flow most times. It's you can chase and chase and you may get somewhere, but usually someone finds something and refers it, and it just happens organically.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to say is that throughout the years that we've made films and our, shall we say, less successful attempts, I don't really want to sort of pigeonhole people or typecast people, but we're kind of the creative side. And sometimes I think it's difficult for creative people to work on sales because it's a different sort of personality type. You have to deal with a lot of rejection and all that kind of stuff and just kind of work through and it's numbers or whatever. But we have over the years gone to the DVD replication company and printed out 100 DVDs and flown to a festival and literally knocked on every single door saying, please, 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 would you watch our documentary? And I think the thing is that maybe that missing part is you do learn, one, who to talk to and how to talk to them. Because I remember my first... we went to Cannes and I bumped into a very famous film producer. And I couldn't articulate anything. And, sales meetings are like, I don't know, maybe Netflix in the beginning, and you can't get the words out that you want and it doesn't work. And you sort of sit there and think, oh, he's had too much coffee. And you do learn that process. So I think, like with the latest film, is that as we've kind of learned a little bit from dealing with distributors and pitching our films to people, that you do become a little bit more relaxed about it. And it's much easier to get that vision across to somebody. You do have to be careful with a lot of these companies because there are, lots of hidden small print. And you only learn what is a good deal or a half decent deal the more you kind of explore that area. So if you can learn about sales and pitching, if you want to do that as a person, otherwise find somebody that knows what they're doing. And that's essentially what happened with us, is we were lucky enough to get into the festival, then we were lucky enough to meet somebody and we made a deal with him, and then of course he championed our film to the kind of the corporate world, where we probably wouldn't have been able to do that without his help.
It's a different animal, that whole side of things.
And we don't want to do it as well, I think, is well, I don't want to do it.
That's fair. Fair enough. Absolutely.
I stuck with it, and I know that I do. So.
Well, and the time it'll take away from you that you could be spending on creating new ideas for more projects as well, which is what you really want to be doing.
Exactly.
Also, I just like to add, I think this is so, the Pickup Game has been a success in the sense that it's played at some very prestigious festivals. It's been on some very big television networks. It's had some really, really good reviews. And it's great when you meet someone at a festival and they come over to you and they're like, oh my God, I saw your film. And I was talking about my boyfriend and just like, wow, okay, I've really sort of connected. Someone is really connected, but that's a very, very cool experience. But it's not like we've suddenly just arrived at this point where everything is yes and everything is easy. I mean, not to labor the point, but I mean, Hot Docs is a really good festival. Doc NYC is a really good festival. We won Best Feature, International Feature at Melbourne Documentary Film Festival, which is also very good. We cannot find a film festival in the UK that will take the film. and we're from the UK and it's a UK film.
That's interesting though, because I don't know, it's different markets, but I've had that experience with my films where they've gone into the US and gone to huge short film competitions that are prestigious, and the UK, they don't touch it with a barge pole. And sometimes it can be the theme. Sometimes with festivals, it's, does it fit the vibe of that program? Have they got something? Like, there's so much other stuff going on that you look at it and you go, like, to your point, you're British, you're based in the UK, they should have more residents, but
I don't mean to sound entitled. I'm only saying it because I just want people to understand that it's not like I don't think you ever be, and I don't think you ever get to a point where everything is just yes and everything is straightforward. Again, going back to people like Spielberg, he has talked about things where I think he had trouble getting Lincoln funded because it had a limited audience. And you just think, well, it's Steven Spielberg. How can he struggle to get a project funded? It's ridiculous.
Well, no, but that's also the same with like Johnny Depp and Hunter Thompson trying to make the Rum Diary. It's like,
yeah,
you had Pitt, you had McNulty, you had Johnny Depp, you had Hunter Thompson, and nobody's interested.
It's the time we're in and whether certain films and sort of themes as well fit for just the period that we're in the zeitgeist and you know, the how it's seen from a business side, rightly or wrongly, from how they perceive it, is ultimately, you know, whether it gets funded or not or picked up in a festival or not. It's not a reflection of the quality of a story or of a project if it doesn't get into said festival or picked up by whatever distributor. But you know, from your guys' point of view, it must have been amazing just to get to have the North American and even Australia as well. You mentioned have all those people take it on. And even though it's not gone to UK festivals, still find, and hopefully with the VOD, it's going to find an even bigger audience here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not sure how much you want to talk about this, but that feeling in so we had three screenings at Hot Docs and, we had a great PR lady called Angie, and she kind of got us on morning television, and so there was quite a big quite a lot of noise around the film at the festival,
and a lot of places too. Like I saw you being like IndieWire did some articles on you.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
So you've been in big known publications about this project. It's not, you know, Jim's blog or my podcast.
Yeah, podcast is great. Yeah, I mean. But the third screening was on the Saturday.
Yeah.
And I remember standing outside and there was a line, literally a line around the block of people waiting to get in.
Wow.
And, you know, I've been to Cannes to screen films and we've had two people sitting in the audience that left after 10 minutes, you know. So I think they're in the wrong screening or something. But that experience of that was very, very cool. To have that, There was a point I was trying to make with that, but I lost it now. But it was very, very cool to go and you know, a lot of people. It's kind of a dream, I guess, to have people queuing up outside the cinema to see your film.
Just friends and family that are doing it because you don't know why. Like they're doing it because they have to. But when it's strangers lining around the corner, that's got to be like, there's something here.
So, personally, for me, I don't really like talking in front of people, you know, like a big stage and all that stuff. So it was a very nerve-wracking experience to stand on the stage of a huge cinema, 300-400 people, kind of row by row, explaining your piece of work. But we snuck in the back door on the top tier just to kind of listen, and when you hear people gasping, laughing, the shock is, and that feeling of, okay, emotionally, they understand what we wanted to say. And also kind of, you know, winning an award is like, okay, it's that kind of, not validation, but it's people of your peers who also make films, who also have a good understanding of story and plot and all these kind of other things, have said, yeah, it's good. And that is a really, from our perspective, great achievement, because it's being kind of looked upon as like, okay, you know, you are filmmakers. It's almost like that kind of baptism of, okay, finally we can call ourselves officially, you know, should we say professionals,
I think the thing is, it wasn't that we weren't filmmakers before.
I was just going to say, there's The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. Have you guys read that book?
No.
You know that book where he basically talks about the, you know, an artist as a professional when they just dedicate to doing the craft every day.
Yeah.
Not because they get a paycheck or something external, yes. But that stuff will come. And so the fact that you got that externally is just a reflection of the work you did prior, but it's not that one is above or beyond the other. It's just part of the same thing. So you couldn't have got there if you hadn't have done all the other films and projects beforehand.
Yeah. And I think also this is quite difficult to explain, but I think also there's the thing where with the other projects, they never quite turned out how we wanted them to. And you're always disappointed in yourself, and you just kind of think, oh, and sometimes I was a bit embarrassed to show things to people because I didn't feel it was, and okay, we haven't had that with this, with the pickup game. It's been, but it, in terms of value is not the right word, but it was the same intention that we made everything else with. We just, and in a sort of universal, in a kind of universal sense, it's like it's not like all of that other stuff doesn't have any value, and the pickup game has value just because we got some good reviews and we've made some money from it. I mean, it's not quite difficult to explain. But
at the same point in time, you can see the progression in skill, and yeah. That's kind of more that what I'm kind of getting at. So you can say, okay. If we watch the first ever short film we made, which was a little wind-up toy bouncing along the train tracks on our little DV camera for a couple of $100, to a feature film that's been properly sound designed, color corrected, has had the hours put in that it required, it's a different, it's chalk and cheese, but yeah.
Well, you see the growth, but also I guess you can get even more excited about what could come in the future.
Definitely.
Right? Not to then run past the moment that you're in and disregard enjoying what's happening, but it does, I guess, give that thing of cool, because now the next thing, like what can we open our mind's eye to that maybe being, you know? I wanted to ask, because I'm always intrigued about once you then get a film out into an audience and you get feedback, was there any bit of feedback or consistent feedback you got that surprised you that you didn't expect to get from people at festivals or just that have watched it?
Should I go first? You want to say?
Yeah, no, you can go.
I think the thing that surprised me the most was there was some feedback, and I mean, this is a very emotional subject, and you know, there's been a lot of feedback from all kinds of people. Not all of it good, you know, some people don't like the film at all. But I think the biggest thing for me was there was a criticism that the film was too soft, and it kind of let the pickup guys off the hook. Oh. It wasn't critical enough. And there were many things that I could have imagined the film being criticized for. Not being critical enough was not one of them. I was surprised. Mm. I was surprised from that criticism. And I think some of this kind of speaks to what we were talking about a little bit earlier, which is that people are very siloed now. They exist, you know, they have their opinions, and that's what they believe. And they are not willing to entertain or accept anything that challenges that, or any kind of issue that might be, any kind of point that might be a little bit more complicated. And I think the pickup game has a very strong point of view regarding the pickup industry, but it doesn't tell you what to think. And what's very interesting is how different people react to it. And in some ways, it actually says more about the person's reaction to it. It actually says more about them than it does. I think it's a little bit of a Rorschach in that kind of sense. We've tried to kind of leave it.
Sign of a good film, in my opinion, anyway, just my personal opinion, that it doesn't spoon feed people with, you know, what they can think. They can make a decision either which way. What were people, did you feel a bit surprised or shocked by how deep the rabbit hole goes with that particular world? Or did you think that the audience watching it kind of knew something about it already? Or was it a mixture?
I mean, to be honest, I was really nervous when we were at Hot Docs, because I knew this is quite a potentially very contentious, quite explosive film. And I thought, okay, if we've misjudged this, then we're, you know, this is going to be trouble. And
that was your first public screening. Was that the first?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. And so I was kind of like, and I remember one of the first reviews I read basically said, made that criticism. It lets them off the hook. It's not critical enough, blah, blah, blah. And my original thought was, oh, can we swear on the podcast?
Or, yeah, go for it. Yeah, I haven't yet, sure? But hey, whatever okay. The fuck you like.
All right. Well, my original thought was, fuck, we totally misjudged this. But actually, I don't think that's a fair criticism in my mind. I think it is critical enough.
No, I'd agree from having watched it just the other day that it definitely, it you're not trying to sort of burn them to the ground, but you are critiquing them in a way that actually, again, shows the insecurities and shows mm-hmm. all the flaws and shows that what they're doing is, I mean, I didn't know half the stuff that went that deep that shows how they're preying on people in many ways. And I don't think that it shies away from showing that. You have to. It's not like, you know, if it was Hitch as a documentary, that's letting them off the hook. But this was a full expose of many of them where some of the stuff that goes on, you just look at it. And I said to you before we hit roll and before Barnaby joined, I was shaking my head probably every other frame. Because I'm just like, how, what? Like, I knew of some of these things. I just didn't know how psychotic some of it can be, just pathological. Mm. And one of the guests even mentions that point that you just see the cold stare in their eyes. And you guys highlighted that it's I think you did a good job.
Well, I think another thing, very criticized, and I'll make his point, but a lot of people like, this should not be, there are some people that think that this documentary should not be broadcast.
Yeah,
we shouldn't even be having a discussion about this, and we should not be giving the pickup artists any platform at all.
I was about to say, my mind went to, yeah, the pickup artists won't want you to show it, but actually, I just halfway through you saying, I was like, actually, you're probably talking about people who don't. Yeah,
yeah. There's a school of thought out there, which is that these people should not have any airtime, and we should erase them from. I mean, to me, that and the. It's not critical enough. I don't know. I just that was very surprising.
They don't care about airtime though, because it's such a subculture that this is all happening within the internet and forums and all this stuff, right? So it doesn't need to. I think even one of the guys said they don't care if it's in the mainstream, because it's not a mainstream thing, even though thousands or millions of people know about it. So. Actually, it needs to be sort of put out there in more of a mainstream level. And that was sort of my initial sort of part with the question, which was because people who are maybe seeing it as these documentary festivals perhaps aren't as aware of the subculture, did you find some of them were actually shocked about the depths of which the Yellow Brick Road kind of goes?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I think the thing is with this particular topic, it's psychology and its sales and its neurolinguistic programming manipulation and I mean the list of sort of the psychology stuff goes a mile deep as well. One of the things that maybe we don't kind of touch on so much with the documentary is that these sort of techniques are kind of applied to lots of other stuff like sales, government, you know, and it's kind of. This is an important topic that people need to be aware of. And this is the first step to try and make people understand how maybe to combat these kind of techniques, not just in this particular subject matter, but in their everyday life. And I think the film kind of looks at it's the continual bombardment of advertising and media, and we'll call it fake films, and you know, anyone can edit something to look a particular way, that people are sort of blindsided and they don't realize that they're actually being sold or manipulated into feeling a certain way or doing a certain thing. And that's a very difficult sort of topic to discuss. And going back to sort of the polarization, lots of people are very kind of stuck in a particular sort of feeling about a subject. And like Matt says, is that we have people review the film on Amazon and iTunes, and these individuals hadn't even watched the movie. They give it no stars and they write a really bad review. And they even include in that review that they haven't watched it. And it's like, okay, not that we're trying to force you to, you know, watch the film, but watch the film and then you give that review. And we like to take that information to kind of go, right, okay, now we can understand somebody else's perspective on something, rather than criticize a particular, you know, a particular project without any knowledge. It's quite, quite a difficult pill to swallow.
I guess that's another reflection of just what the internet is, though. Like, the subculture of the theme of this particular film is intrinsically reflected in people who are going online and happy to post anything to anyone about anything. And this just, you know, so happens to be about the pickup community. But to your point, yeah, it is rife in any walk of life. And it really is, I guess, about how we can cultivate our own minds to be functioning in the way that we want them to function for us as individuals, and not being sort of swayed by external stuff to the point that we don't know if our thoughts and opinions are ours anymore.
Yeah.
Which is a much bigger conversation than just the pickup community. But this is a microcosm where you can see how it really can unravel, sometimes really scarily. Like, some of those stories that you guys have highlighted are nuts. So you guys, as a filming process, you mentioned obviously was it 4 years in the making?
Just very quickly, could I just add to that? I just wanted to say that I think sometimes, because it's a very, very emotional subject, and obviously there are people out there that have had very bad experiences with, you know, there are some people out there that have had very bad experiences with this kind of thing. And I understand that they may not be able to separate their distaste and their kind of emotional revulsion to the industry from the film. They might not be able to separate that. So to be fair to some of those people that have written, and you know, Barney is right, we've had reviews where people haven't even watched it, and they've, this shouldn't be out there, this is disgusting. I had this experience with this pickup artist, and I'm absolutely shocked and horrified that there is even a documentary made about these people. I do understand, just to try and be compassionate and fair to those people, especially if you had a bad experience in that area, I understand why they might react that way. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah, no, yeah. For sure, totally. I think my initial, probably wrongly, impression of people going on Amazon and putting reviews were probably those people that are students and part of, for lack of a term, some of the cults that some of these programs can be, and just defending sort of the fake external gods that exist within.
Well, we've had that as well.
Yeah, no, what I was imagining most of, where you're probably getting rampaged by that. Which is, you know, just a different side of the same coin, I suppose. But for the ones that have been on the other end, yes, you're right. Like, I totally get that. That's, yeah, different. Some of those stories, which I won't, you know, people can watch and find out for themselves how far some of this goes, they're just like crazy. As a process of filming, I was going to say that for you guys, so it was over, was it 4 years? Is that right? That you filmed it?
It wasn't 4 years every day.
No, but sure.
The whole
it's a lot of pickup artistry for anyone to take, man.
The whole process took about 4 years. So we, sorry, go on.
I was going to say, so you guys were flying out to the States, and you know, you're in London, and you were actually interviewing them, but also going to some of these boot camps and filming them there. Like, how did that work, I guess? How did you get some of them to, if you can speak to it, agree to do that?
So I think we were quite lucky in terms of one of the first interviews that we did was with Ross Jeffries, who is kind of considered the godfather of that particular industry. Mm-hmm. And he was doing his last seminars in UK, and he kind of agreed to meet us. We kind of pitched him the sort of what we wanted, and you know, was he available for an interview? And he gave us an interview in this hotel room. And I think probably because of the fact that he was such a big name, that opened up a lot of doors for a lot of the other kind of individuals to kind of be more willing to talk to us.
I mean, essentially, he was coming to England to do his last seminar, and he said, "If you meet me, and you know, basically, kind of take me for dinner, and transfer me between the airports because he was coming into one airport and leaving from another. He said, "We'll talk about it, and I'll think about giving you an interview." And then we met him. We went and sort of kind of had like a little bit of time together. And then he said, "Okay, fine. When I come back from Europe, I'll give you a." I think he was going to Italy or something. He said, "When I come back from Italy, I'll give you a couple of hours." And then that, like Barney said, that kind of first interview. Then you can go to other people and say, "Well, we've interviewed Ross Jeffries." And also, I think having, you know, although California High wasn't exactly a household name, we could show them the trailer, we could show them some of the other stuff we've done. So we could kind of say, look, you know, and the production value was better than the kind of, that sounds a bit vain, but it was better than what the pickup companies were putting out. So I guess they thought, well, these guys look half bona fide. You know, why not?
Sure. Did you guys, as you were meeting all these different people, was there anything that you guys sort of came across that you had and expected that maybe you can't talk about if it's in the documentary, or is anything that really struck you as being something that you weren't aware of as individuals? Because I assume you were also unraveling some of what this thing is as the time progressed as well. Mm-hmm. Or did you know about it before you got into it? Like, how has it evolved for you guys?
I think the thing that I realized from doing the documentary is the value of honesty in relationships. And I know that sounds really, really obvious, but when you spend a huge amount of time with people that have essentially reinvented themselves or are reinventing themselves as someone else or an alpha male, or they're kind of playing a character, and you see the long-term effects that has on them and on their relationships with people and on their relationships with their partners. And it was always the kind of thing, okay, if not pick up, then what is the alternative? If we can't, because initially we didn't realize how deep the rabbit hole goes. So it just seems like, well, it's a few tips and tricks and it's some conversations. And, you know, okay, what is the alternative? It's not enough just to criticize what these people are doing. Need to try and provide some kind of an alternative. And I think we didn't really have time to properly get into this in the film, but I do think there's a thing of honesty is incredibly important. And there were so many pickup students that I met, and I just thought, man, you guys are cool. As in, you have everything going for you. You've got a belief in your head that you're not enough and that this pickup course will somehow kind of fill that gap. Or It was interesting. I mean, there were some people that were obviously very, very socially awkward, and you know, I can understand. Okay, I'm sure they have a hard time going out and meeting people, and so I can understand why they would think, okay, I need to join this pickup. But there were plenty of other guys that I met, and I just thought, you have everything going for you already. All you're missing is like some degree of self belief. Or not even maybe self acceptance, just yeah.
It's one of those that was like, a kind of like Barney said before, that it sort of self perpetuates into all facets of life. It's not just
absolutely.
I mean, because it's hard to kind of, you know, pick one particular thing that we experienced or felt or learned along the process of making the documentary, because there is so much.
Sure,
but I think the thing is that. Almost, because maybe sometimes you want to hold back your opinions on some things. But if you kind of go down that mindset of a cult, how do people get tied up into believing X and carry out Y? You, over the whole process of making the film, I kind of feel, okay, you know what? I think I kind of understand how that can happen. Because we have to bear in mind, I spoke to lots of different people. We spoke to the pickup artists, we spoke to the instructors, we spoke to the students, we spoke to people that have you know, experienced this from, you know, from the other side. We were lucky enough to meet a marketing guru who kind of worked behind the scenes for the business side of stuff. And I think the thing is the more that we watched the stuff every single day, it's like a repeating mantra, mantra, mantra. And ideology that personally it's wrong, this kind of behavior, and taking advantage of people in terms of making money. Also to kind of look at, there is a need, otherwise these companies wouldn't exist, but there's nothing to govern these companies and to make sure that what they're doing is actually helping. And especially within sort of the self-help industry, there's a lot of harm that's coming from that, because anyone can just, as it says in the documentary, crop up on YouTube or Instagram and preach to say, I can change your life because I'm a guru. And the proof of the pudding is, you know, it's like, okay, you guys need to be sort of managed and overseen by a governing body of some sorts, because you don't have any medical experience. But it's all funneling the sales, it's funneling the videos, and it's all about money, and it's all about the corruption of anything in order to get to that dollar. And I think if you sit down and watch that every day, all day for 4 years, it does break after a while.
Mm.
You can see how people can get beaten down to actually change their way of being, to conform to that, especially if you have no one else to kind of help guide you in a different direction. So.
Mm.
Yeah, the scary thing about that is that, like you said, you can it's like whack-a-mole, right? Right? One goes, but you can have another one pop up right the next second. Yeah. And so ultimately, it then has to always go back to the individual. And so what on a bigger level is not happening in the world, where people, men or women, feel like they can trust their own innate inner compass enough to make judgments on who they are being worthy enough for whatever they want, whether it's, you know, dating or a career or whatever, you know, insert desire here. Because my thing would just be, you can take some of these guys down, but then someone else come up with a new program. I mean, I knew there were books, because I knew about the game, right? So I was like, okay, so books and stuff, and maybe like online newsletters. I knew it went that far. And having worked in digital marketing, I don't know why I didn't piece together the two. Because I was like, oh no, yeah, like now there's sales funnels. And now you then have it become this big thing, where I didn't know they did like $10,000 courses or like $5,000 weekends where you can meet them. And then you just realize, actually, it's just a huge money-making scheme.
Yeah.
Of which a little bit might actually, yes, work for sure. Mm-hmm. But all you have to show is the bits that work. And if you tap into the right insecurities at the right time with a well-crafted video on Facebook ads,
it's far out of control. Yeah.
It's not surprising, because, you know, if that's how some elections, no, we don't get political, but if that's how elections have been tampered with. No, but again, it's a micro thing that's still happening in the macro. And so in some ways, what you've done is tapping into one thing, but on a bigger level, it's still speaking to how that is happening with pick your poison.
Yeah. Well, that's really rewarding that you took that from it, because that is the point, really, that we're trying to make. And I think that's what makes the pickup industry so interesting, is it is a reflection and a crystallization of all those things that make us human. We want to feel desirable. We want to find a mate. Most, you know, we want to have a friendship group. We want to feel worthy. And all of that plays into all of those kind of things. And like you say, the techniques that have been used, and the getting people to buy into your worldview or your frame, you know, this is to use like an NLP thing. It's a very common thing in the pickup world, is like control the frame. It is a little microcosm of the human condition. And I think that's actually why people respond to it as a kind of subject matter, and the documentary and the books and everything that's written about it.
It's fascinating for both, you know, good and bad reasons, which is kind of again what I said to you, Matt, before we joined, where I was like, yeah, I watched the film at the weekend. I don't want to say it's good, even though it is good in terms of a piece of work, but the content of it, I'm just like, oh man, like, yeah, people should definitely watch it, just because I think they'll be many people who didn't know how far some of this stuff goes and some of the things that have actually happened that go far beyond doing an online course or watching a video or reading a book and then going to a bar and trying to talk to a woman. Like, it's, yeah, it's a little, some of it was a little psychotic. It was a bit scary. And well edited. How did you find that? Because you spoke about the edit and the story being difficult. Let's get back to filmmaking here. Because obviously telling a story through a documentary is still imperative, but to your point, you didn't have a protagonist that was a person. It was more a theme or sort of an idea. How did you sort of find that part of the process, and sort of how did you get to the story in the way that you've told it?
So I think, I mean, one of the things that I always said from the beginning is we, and again, I don't put myself in the same category, but we wanted to be like Goodfellas.
Okay.
And then when you start watching Goodfellas, there's this thing of like, oh, look at these mafia people. Look at this kind of interesting, not interesting, but it's kind of shocking, but it's, and but there is that. And I think this is like a really uncomfortable truth with the pickup industry, is that there is that kind of male fantasy of, you know, what are the secrets? What are the secrets to winning it? Like, what is it? Is there a system, and can I learn it? And so there's kind of that intrigue. But the thing is, as Goodfellas goes on, the more it goes on, the more you realize just how fucked up it is from all the, and that was kind of the thread that we had. So we sort of plotted out, okay, this is, we'll do the first third or the first half will be very much kind of presentational almost. We're just going to show what these guys do. We're going to show how it works. We're going to introduce you to some of the concept. And then you can look at the costs of that and the kind of like deconstruct that in the later part of the film. So there was an arc. It was a kind of a broad arc. But then what becomes very difficult is, okay, what elements do you choose to tell that part of the story? You know, how do you, I mean, there's so many techniques that we could have listed, but it's like, okay, well, which ones do you focus on, for example? And I think also that thing, that early part of the film where it is just presented, I think that's what puts people on the back foot a little bit, because I think sometimes they just come to it and they're like, what? I mean, somebody actually said, somebody who we were talking to about it, she'd watched the film. This is, it was like a marketing person that we were talking to, and she said, I watched the film and I really like it, and I think it's a really well made film, but for the first 20 or 30 minutes I was thinking, where the fuck is this going? Because it's not immediately obvious. Sure. it's meant to be a slow burn, and I think in some ways that's some of the bits that people don't like. They want that opinion up front, and we deliberately didn't do that. Now, that was a choice that we made.
I think it worked, because you're introducing the characters in the play like any fictional piece, where you have to know who they are and what world they operate in before you can then evolve the story further.
Can I add something to what Matt said? For complete honesty, and I think this is quite an important.
I'm going to stop you right there.
you have a pickup artist program, and you want me to join?
Yeah, exactly. $19.99.
I'll get my credit card.
Money back down.
I can't remember. It's some sales thing or some worky thing. It's the 5 P's. It's like prior preparation prevents piss poor performance. Right. So Matt's completely right in everything that he said. One of the small things that he left out, and one of the reasons why we ran over time, is that we didn't start the documentary with a clear idea of what that story is going to be. We met a lady that was working for a pickup company. She was used as kind of like a conversational person that people would practice on. And then it kind of went from there. And then, you know, learning about the game and all this kind of stuff. So what we had is we had an awful lot of footage. We had an awful lot of information. We had the you know, the rights to use the YouTube videos and all this kind of stuff. But we didn't have a very clear linear story of, you know, okay, we're going to start here in 1980s, and we're going to end here in 2000, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
And it's a huge puzzle that takes a lot of time. And one of the reasons that we struggled to deliver on time was because it is such a complex subject. There's many different ways of telling the story. There's many different ways of coming at the subject matter. And we had to kind of distill down hundreds of hours of footage into how do we present this in a way that is clear for our audience to follow. And as Matt said, you know, there was the choice to withhold some of, you know, the more juicy content until the viewer had at least appreciated or understood a little bit where this kind of mindset came from and how it's got to where it is today. You have to understand the history.
Mm-hmm.
So we couldn't jump straight in and, you know, overload you with information because then you'd be a little bit lost in this world that is very, very complicated. Yeah, so we weren't just as prepared as possible as we should have been.
Just to go back to one of the things that, because I know you wanted to talk about a little bit from a practical point of view, I just want to talk about how we got the money and how that actually happened.
Sure.
So we'd interviewed this guy, Ross Jeffries. We'd started to interview some other people, and then we put together like a 6 or 7 minute teaser reel. It wasn't really a trailer. It was more a kind of this is how it was. And then we went around and spoke to lots of different financing companies in the UK, which were willing to finance the film, but it would have meant we would have given up creative control. And that was a very, very difficult thing to do, because it's like, well, we want the money, but I really want to try and keep control. And then I was at the Cannes Film Festival, and we'd been looking for probably the best part of 6 to 12 months for the actual financing. So we had some interviews in the bag, and we had the trailer, the kind of teaser reel, but there was still a lot of filming left to do, and there was obviously all the editing and post-production. And I just met this company, and I had accepted. I kind of reconciled myself to that. Okay, fine. Do you know what? This is not ideal. We're going to have to give up creative control, but we've exhausted the avenues. There's no other options. And I was walking back to my apartment, and I don't know if you've been to Cannes, but there's a big kind of conference hall in Cannes called the Palais. Mm-hmm. And I was walking through the Palais, and I bumped into an actress friend of mine, and she said, "Oh, Matthew, oh, hi, how are you? You've got to meet this guy. You've got to meet this guy, Will, from New Zealand. He makes documentaries too." And then I said, "Oh, hi." And then Will told me about his documentary. And he said, "What are you?" He said, I'm a kind of property mogul. I've made a lot of money in real estate in New Zealand. And now I started making documentaries." And I was kind of sitting there. And then I started telling him about the Pickup Game. And I showed him the trailer. And he's really psyched. Like, "Oh, my God, how do I not know about this? This is incredible." And he keeps talking about how he's putting money into his own documentaries. And I'm sitting there going, "Well, can I ask this guy if he, what about putting money into someone else's documentary?" And then eventually I said, "Well, would you be interested in funding like someone else's?" And he said, "Well, yeah, you know, how much do you want?" And literally that was it. It was like a 15-20 minute conversation.
Isn't it, how it all can play out, especially when you like got to that sort of last ditch moment where you're about to just give it all up.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean it is remarkable. But I think the thing is, it was such an intriguing idea for him, and he kind of thought, okay, you know what? Let's, and credit to him. I mean, back then it was just an idea and a kind of 6 minute, 7 minute trailer. I think, yeah, you know, definitely should be grateful for the fact that he was willing to, and we were much. He didn't know me from Adam.
When was this? Was this like 2015, 2016?
So this was 2017.
Okay.
So then this was the last day that I was there. And then he said, honestly, I thought it was a wind up. You know, I thought it was some kind of joke and then he said, "Look, I'm coming to Sheffield. I'm flying to Sheffield DocFest, the Sheffield Documentary Festival in the UK. Come up and meet me." and we'll go over the facts and figures, and we'll draw up a proper formal agreement. And then 3 weeks later, it was all signed, and he paid. So the idea was he would pay in installments, and he paid the first installment. And so it took 12 months of going around and all these formal business meetings. And okay, the offer was there, but it wasn't. And the great thing about it is that we got to keep creative control.
Yeah, yeah.
And ownership of the, you know, we split the ownership 50-50. So we still had some ownership of the film. Whereas had it been any other financing companies, we would have lost ownership.
All worked out much, much better in the long run than clearly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it comes out July. When does it come out?
July, June 14th.
June 14th in the UK. Yeah. And
in the UK. Yeah.
And in the States, it's already available for people if they're in the States or.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
it's on.
On Stars, did you say?
Yeah, it's on Stars and it's on Apple TV and Amazon.
Oh, it's on Apple TV. Oh,
yeah. Okay.
Cool.
Or iTunes, very, you know, whatever you want.
Yeah. Whatever you want to call it. Very cool. Yeah, such a fascinating thing. I think people definitely are going to find it both intriguing and shocking in an equal part. Is there anything that you guys sort of want to say or speak to before we wrap up here about the project or anything just filmmaking-wise that you think is going to be useful for the audience? Many of them can be like recent film grads. I don't know if there's any closing bits from you guys you want to share.
I'm good to shoot. The only thing that I would say is just keep going. It's a little bit like you said kind of earlier on, it's almost like a passion project. You know, it's work from the heart, is that if you really do want to do this kind of stuff, you have to keep going. And, you know, I'm lucky that I've got Matt to kind of help encourage us along the way. So, you know, it is a long road, but you just keep plodding along, and hopefully one day the sun shines and it changes. So.
Matt, what about you?
Is there anything that you think that we haven't touched on, or what do you think would be most useful for the people watching to comment on?
I think we've spoken quite a lot about sort of the film itself and the process. I guess if you were to crystallize in your mind like a key bit of advice you would be giving to someone a bit younger who was getting into the film game, who maybe hasn't quite had that festival breakout film or distributed film yet, you know, what would that be? What would you say to them in terms of like a nugget soundbite that we can then use on Facebook ads to put them down a funnel?
So I would also say you've got to go and check these things out, even if it's your local film festival or, you know, one within your country, especially at the moment with the pandemic and stuff, you might not be able to travel too far, or online festivals. See what other people are making. You know, go and actually have that experience of attending a film festival. You know, you probably get lucky and meet like-minded people.
It's that community part, which is a big part of what the documentary is too, in terms of people trying to search for a community. And ultimately, you know, we're all kind of striving for that connection. And I think as a filmmaker, it's easy to get lost in my project and that's it, and you don't see the
because I mean, it's a bit of a lonely process as well sometimes, especially when you're editing. You know, just sitting in front of the computer and stuff. So it's good to get out and meet other people and collaborate, I think.
I think what could I offer? I guess but I think one of the things I would say is, you know, I really feel like we've seen it all. We've had the absolute shit kicked out of us trying to sell films, and we've literally been laughed out of the room and had people email us for pitches and very, very unkind, very unpleasant emails, and had screenings that no one turned up to. That's all part of the, I think that's part of the process. You know, I remember when we started out, somebody watching a film and not liking it, I used to take that really personally. And now somebody can and has written, you know, a scathing review, and you're just like, okay, fine. You learn to disassociate and you learn to stop taking it so personally. And I think that is part of, I think there's a lot of value in that, to be able to just say, okay, no problem. And to be able to take feedback on the chin and then sort it yourself. But it never gets straightforward. You know, it's not like we, like I said earlier, it's not like we suddenly arrive at a point where all the doors are open and everybody says yes. We are having some very exciting meetings at the moment, and there's a lot of things that have come from this, and there's a lot of potentially great opportunities, but we're still pitching, we're still having to, sure, and we're still getting the no's, and we're still going down the different avenues all the time that ends up like, okay, this doesn't go anywhere, we have to go back.
It's also coming up with new ideas as well. And I mean, go right back to the beginning of our conversation, is that we kind of got into the documentary world by making a dodgy independent film and a documentary of the making of. And then we kind of went off and we did a couple of other sort of documentaries, Burning Man and all this kind of other stuff, which led to where we are now. And so, you know, maybe we might even say, okay, well, let's try and switch or include a lot more sort of reconstruction within. And that's our tiny little bridge back to feature films. Yep. So, you know, each different idea comes with something new and exciting. So, you know, once one thing is done, start thinking about the next. But, you know, as Matt was saying, we're still working hard to distribute the film. We're looking at, yeah, you know, educational releases and whatnot. There is talk about a small cinema release in Australia off the back of the Melbourne documentary. So, you know, we're still working on that, but we're focusing on some new ideas as well.
It's part of the cycle, though, right? You kind of always have to be juggling a few different things. And when you have those meetings, it's always that thing of, cool, what else have you got? And what else have you got? And it's that, you know, you want to have a few, even if it's just ideas, if nothing else, in there, so you're ready. Especially with the momentum that you guys have, you kind of want to strike, I'm sure, whilst the iron is hot. Do you think feature films that are fictional based are going to be something that you will want to bridge back to in the long run, or is it just see where things take you?
I'd definitely like to do that.
I mean, we still have lots of ideas that we've incubated over the years that we're working on, and, you know, It is a question of kind of which way do we go now? But also in the same way, the work of the previous documentary is not finished. And so you're like, we've still got to devote this much time to that. How do you split your time between earning money to put food on the table and also go on with another new idea? You know, and people are like, what are you doing? Another idea? You have to finish with the last one. And it's like,
but that's what it is. That's what it is, right? Mm. Like, you know, and I think you'd get stale creatively if you weren't thinking of new ideas. It just, like you said at the beginning, these things take years. And so new idea now is a seed that's being planted to germinate in 3 or 4 years from now. Not And you can't wait for 4 years and then be like, oh, cool. Well, let's just, you know, have this full grown tree.
The annoying thing is when you have an idea and you don't do it when you wanted to do it.
And if someone else does it.
Somebody else. Like, no, I knew that we should have done it. You know,
I'm pretty sure those aren't the words you say when you find that, to be fair. I'm pretty sure, because I say words that are not like that.
Yeah. I mean,
it shows you can have good ideas. That's how I take it. It just shows that you have a good propensity to come up with you know, good concepts. Go on, Matthew, you were going to say something.
No, it was something small, but I remember sort of the final day of editing for the pickup game, and I went home, and I think we're so tired and so burnt out, and I was like, right, that's it. I never want to make another documentary again. As I'm sick of it. And then a couple of days later, I was like, well, you know, that's an interesting idea. and then you kind of find it again. But I know this is a bit of a platitude, but like, I think also try and enjoy these experiences, because like you say, you meet lots of interesting people, not all of whom are nice, but like, these are really quite cool life experiences that you can have. And I think it is very easy to get fixated on, I just want a successful movie. I want to be on the cover of XYZ or whatever, and live in my mansion in LA. And you know, it's like, fair enough, you know, but there's a lot, there's a lot to be said, I think, for just trying to appreciate the process itself and the people that you meet. And we've made some very cool friends over the years that have turned into sort of lifelong friends doing this. And, you know, when you're kind of, I just want this to work, and when there's all the pressure, that doesn't necessarily take that off. But
and we have almost disowned each other on numerous occasions as well.
Well, this is the last bit. This is one of the things that, you know, when things got very stressful in the pickup, like in the process of editing the pickup game, we had a sort of story editor come on. I mean, the fights that we used to have in front of her, I don't know what she was telling everybody else. And I think it's very, very important to have someone that you can have candid conversations with and give them candid feedback, where it doesn't become personal. And I think this is one thing that we do have between us, is I can say, I don't like that, or I don't think it works for, yeah.
That's what you were saying before about honest relationships, which doesn't have to be romantic. It's every relationship, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, clearly sort of how a good film can be made, and it's an essential ingredient, and also a huge theme of what the film is. And I feel like somehow that sort of buttoned things off quite nicely here at the end in a very poignant way. Guys, it's been a blast chatting to you both.
Thank you for having us on.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to seeing more of the success of the film and seeing what you guys do next. Because now that I know about your work, I'm like, well, where do you go from the pickup game? What's next? Like, that's going to be... It's going to be intriguing. You have ideas. You have ideas. I can tell. They're bubbling.
There's a few things, but it's almost like,
take a vacation first.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah.
Amazing. All right, you guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for having you on.
Time, yeah.
Take it easy.
Thank you very much.
Stay well. Bye-bye. Bye.